first of mine?
Hey, Paul. Paul.
First bill of school.
Oh, okay.
The Transportation Committee will come to order. The first bill on the agenda today is Senator Scogin's bill. And we've got quite of an agenda. There is a quorum present, so we're going to take action immediately. Senator Scogin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scogin, I understand that you have an amendment or two.
Yeah, I believe I'm going to have two amendments, Mr. Chair. And I would like to first move the A1.
Senator Dibble offers the A1 amendment. This is a first stop for the bill, so these are all author's amendments.
Thank you.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail.
Mr. Chair, I also have the A2.
And Senator Dibble offers up the A2 amendment. Once again, this is a... This is out of consideration for the author. Senator Dibble, on the A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion does prevail. Senator Scogin, now your bill is in the shape that you need it, so why don't you tell us what we're doing here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. On Senate File 315, here we have a bill before us that is a result of a unfortunate circumstance, in fact, a tragic circumstance. You might remember the Pelican Rapids school was on a trip to Chicago about a year ago. They had a bus accident near St. Michael, and a young girl was killed that was riding in the bus. And as a result, the family and Pelican Rapids is in my Senate district. The family came to us and asked if there couldn't be a more safe way to transport students. And we certainly started to look at legislation that might answer that question so that another family didn't have to go through this. And we started looking at school buses and seat belts. And we found that, and the State Patrol came to me with some concerns about that. And we certainly, we then fairly quickly moved away from that, and these amendments addressed some of that. And then we got into motor coaches, which schools can't own and operate to pick up students on a regular basis. And so it was a learning experience for me, Mr. Chair and committee. And so we thought, well, how about having these motor coaches that schools rent on occasion to move sports teams or band and choirs around, have them retrofitted? Well, they're not built to be retrofitted. They're built for touring and standing up on and going back to use the washroom. And the roofs and the windows are not designed anything like a school bus. A school bus is designed for the passengers to be seated. If a mishap occurs, there are sections of that bus that stay together, that protect the students. And this committee probably understands and has heard all of that testimony. So we have now moved to the point on Senate File 315, and where we are going to look forward from here and ask that when schools are hiring motor coaches for extracurricular activities, that they hire transportation that has the restraints in them.
I'm sorry, Senator Scogin. With the amendments to your bill, let me see if I understand this correctly. You're looking at just those motor coaches that are manufactured after 2012. This would give the industry enough time to ramp up and meet that need.
That's all right.
There, you have a couple testifiers. Or
I thought the State Patrol might want to speak to it. I don't. The family was going to, but they chose not to come down. So
yeah.
I told them I would walk it down here for them.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody for or against. I guess they can, as our good friend Senator Metzen says, if you're for me, come and join me at the table.
I don't see anybody fighting to get to the bat rack. So is Mr. Moran and Mr. Jannings here to provide some testimony? Please come to the table. Now, you two gentlemen operate buses yourselves?
Yes, sir.
We do.
Mr. Moran, you want to start and state your name for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Michael Moran. I represent the Minnesota Charter Bus Operators Association, a group of about 40 independent motor coach operators throughout the state of Minnesota. To a great extent, the amendments offered here alleviate a lot of our concerns. However, the committee should be aware that there is currently federal testing, crash testing of motor coaches that is ongoing, and our group would like you to consider possibly waiting until there is a national standard for seat belts in school buses that will address seat anchorages, passenger restraint, some of the forces that may be in there. I'd hate to see Minnesota develop a standard and then have our motor coaches not be able to be used out of state if the national standard exceeds Minnesota's standard.
Mr. Moran, when do you expect for those standards to be public?
The Transportation Resource Board under the National Highway Administration conducted tests in December of 2007. Results were supposed to be in by the end of this year. However, they are not here yet. I expect them this year. Also, the National Transportation Resources Board has made motor coach safety one of their priorities for this year. I expect that there will be standards out this year, sir.
Okay, thank you. Is that your testimony?
Yes, sir.
Are you done? Okay, great. Mr. Jannings.
Hi, my name is Steve Jannings. I represent the interests of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, Cavalier Coaches, the Owatonna Bus Company, and the Albert Lee Bus Company. And I would like to say that having sat through the House version of this bill yesterday, It becomes apparent that this bill was well-intentioned, and it comes from the heart, and we can certainly appreciate that, but it is simply the wrong venue. This is a bill that belongs before federal legislators. If we were to enact a bill today that were to demand standards of seat belts and lap and harness systems on motor coaches, it would be in advance of what federal standards are asking for. And if the federal agencies did not act within the next 3 years before July of 2012, we would then be faced with a retrofit application, which is something I don't think any of us want to get into, because it's unproved, it's untried, and creates a potential liability for the operators of motor coaches. Great idea, but it's just simply the wrong place, wrong time.
Thank you, Mr. Jannings. Mr. Jannings and Mr. Moran, you realize that the effective date on this is not until after 2012.
Right.
Okay. Senator Scogin, here's what I would like to do.
Sure.
I have a couple contacts out there with the NTSB, and we'll see if we can't expedite this, them compiling their report a little bit. In the meantime, why don't we put this bill on the table here, get a little information from the feds as to what direction they're going to take, and hold this over for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Mwah.
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I had one clarifying question I'd like to ask Mr. Jannings when you're finished.
Oh, okay. And that way we'll have a little better idea where we're at the federal level. And if it comes back that they're going to have that report done soon, I think that we should probably hold off.
Sounds fair, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Mott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jennings and Mr. Moran, I understand your concern about the implications for your operation. But I have to say that I thought that Senator Scogin did a really great job with his amendments. He very, very narrowly tailored his requirements to only the motor coaches that are under contract with schools. So I'm a little bit confused about the broader implication that you think this has for your operation. Do you not have the ability, or in the way that you operate your business, not only apply to those vehicles you have that are under contract with school districts?
I understand what you're saying. The problem with it is that the bill asks for an approved, if I remember reading that correctly, it says an approved lap or shoulder harness. Approved by whom is the question.
Okay.
There currently are no standards, and it's completely up to the operator to supply them or not supply them. It's not a requirement. And if you were to arbitrarily equip your motor coaches with lap belts or shoulder harnesses or a three-point system that wasn't offered as an original manufacturer's piece of equipment, you place yourself in a position of liability. If, in the worst-case scenario, you were to have a catastrophic accident that resulted in the death of some of your passengers, and then you discover that you had a restraint system that was retrofitted, that wasn't original equipment, your liability is probably enormous. So,
thank you. I understand now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you actually got to the point I was going to ask you about liability, because I agree with you. Unless a manufacturer does it or the federal government tells us how to do it, you guys place yourself in a lot of liability. I do think it's a great bill in terms of that it comes from the heart and we're trying to fix some things that we've been looking at. But I think just in the way that it would have to be implemented is kind of troubling. So,
if I could offer a comment to the senators present, what would really be a terrific bill if someone wanted to champion this cause is to look at driver qualifications and hours of service. That is truly what happened in this case, which was the knee-jerk reaction to that accident with the Pelican Rapids group. This poor guy was driving overnight. Probably if he wasn't out of his hours of service, he was very close. And the poor guy fell asleep, ran off the exit ramp, and the results were horrific. If we want to start looking at something that's going to have a positive effect on the safe and efficient transportation of our students, including their extracurricular events, we need to start looking at how and when they are qualified to drive. And overnight, leaving Chicago at 10 p.m. and expecting to arrive in Minnesota safely at 6 a.m. is not, in my mind, a very good plan. And I think we need to start looking at some of those. So if you consider the implications of this, that's the real cause, not having a seatbelt that would have saved that student from being ejected from the bus.
Senator Date.
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions I had is, if you had 42, 50 students or whatever a school bus picks up, who would buckle all the kids in? I mean, I have six grandkids. I have a tough enough time with two. I could see the bus sitting there for 10 minutes at a stop. I mean, who is a bus driver then get to take the, 6-year-old or 8-year-old or whatever, make sure they're buckle them in? And how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Day, I think that's partly why we walked away from the school bus aspect and went to the coaches on special trips. We didn't know how to answer that. And there are certain emergency situations where having them buckled in a school bus would be a detriment.
Mr. Chairman, that's what worries me. So I thought that would be next. So I'm thinking a little around here. You have to always think about 2 or 3 years ahead of time because we just slowly erode. Everybody has. Every time there's any kind of accident and one person has something, we have somebody testifying here, and we all get a little dreary-eyed, and all of a sudden we put things in, and we just did one with a seat belt, and my 6-year-old in Minnetonka the other day put the seat belt back of his head all over again while I'm driving down the road, and I look back there, and I'm just wondering, you know, how many regulations can you have for all of this? And as you well know, and coaches, people do move around. So if you have a group of college kids or whoever, and they're moving from one state to 5 states away, they move around. I mean, you can move around in airplanes. It's kind of a little bit of a freedom deal. So I don't know. I'm just throwing it out. I'm sure I'll be a no vote, whatever comes out of it. But that's just part of the way it is. But trust me, I'll be on the losing side. And that's so you'll be in good company. But I just, Mr. Chairman, I throw it out there.
Okay, Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jennings actually addressed most of my concerns, which I was going to ask Senator Scogin if he thought about any restrictions on the length of time that school motor coach operators could operate the bus, or if you want to comment on that, or.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I actually thought there were restrictions. I didn't include it in the bill. I suppose I should have dug a little deeper, but I thought there were rules about how long a bus driver could drive a bus.
Right, and Mr. Chair, and I don't know who could help me with this, but I'd be curious to know if maybe Senator Olsen knows if motor coach operators are subject to the same regulations and background checks and those types of things as regular school bus drivers. If they're under contract from a district, does that in any way change who qualifies as a driver?
If I could I answer this for you? There certainly are regulations in place, and they're great regulations. They regulate the hours of service and how many off-duty hours drivers have to have before they can drive again and so forth. But where it falls short of truly being effective is that there is no requirement to prohibit overnight travel, for example. As long as a driver has 8 hours off duty before driving their next segment. And what happens here, and this is, I think it's just a little time bomb that's ticking away, waiting to just result in another catastrophic loss, is that it does not prohibit or restrict overnight travel. And when you take a typical motor coach driver who ordinarily drives during the daytime, during his normal waking hours, and then you tell him, okay, in a week, Charlie, you're going to drive from Chicago back to Minneapolis starting at 10 p.m. Well, 2 days before that, maybe he starts to adjust his hours. But how effective is he in adjusting his hours during that nighttime travel? And I think we probably all had at least some information about the circadian rhythms, about our body's natural ability to sleep and rest, and this violates circadian rhythms. I think it's a proven medical fact, but the industry doesn't recognize it and doesn't do anything to prohibit overnight travel. And it's especially troublesome with student groups who, in an effort to realize some economy in traveling overnight, they typically load student groups 3 to 5 p.m., they travel overnight. Let's say they're going to Washington, D.C. or to New York City or any long-distance destination, and they save the cost of the motel room. And that is, it's truly a matter of economy, and they squeeze as much as they possibly can into this to this period of time, but it results in a really risky travel, in my opinion. So,
Senator?
Mr. Chair, I didn't really get my question answered. Mm-hmm. So are motor coaches that are contracted by school districts, are there drivers subject to the same regulation as regular school bus employees?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Bonnoff.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to echo what Mr. Jennings is saying. When my son was a senior in high school, they go to school in Hopkins. They took the football team to play a game in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and so they drove all the way there, played the game, and then because he didn't want to have to control a bunch of football players in a hotel room and he thought they could get in trouble, he said, no, instead we'll drive all night back. And so that driver, his time off was watching the game. And, you know, that night coming back, I was a chaperone on the bus. There was a storm. It was icy. We literally drove all night long. One of the buses broke down. I thought we'd never get home. And it was shortly after that I saw another coach that had an accident like that. And so I think that we ought to consider, and to Senator Day's point, every time there's an accident, we want to make a law. But I think that there are some real regulations we ought to consider with regard to overnight travel and our students.
Captain Urquhart, did the patrol want to weigh in?
Just to answer questions.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
I have one question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Rolstein was up next. I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to say we should bring Captain Urquhart up and just explain hours of service, and especially when there's out-of-state travel involved also.
Captain Urquhart, why don't you come up and give us a couple minutes on hours of service.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Urquhart with the State Patrol. The motor coach industry is subject to hours of service regulations. They are different than the regulations that the property carrying industry is subject to, the truckers. The motor coach industry is still under what we call the old rules of the regulation, and the trucking industry went under the new rules. And of course, motor coach driver is limited to 10 hours of driving in a 24-hour period before they have to take 8 hours off duty or in a sleeper berth. And I think, Mr. Chairman, if I can reflect on what the senator said, is that many times these drivers will go to these events, but they won't rest. They watch the event or act as a spectator, and then of course they have to make the return trip. And the bulk of the industry anticipates that and usually has additional drivers on these trips to compensate for that. And of course that there's a cost issue there, because that's going to be passed on to the school district, of course, and there are issues. And of course the other issue is that whoever charters this bus puts certain amounts of pressure on the motor carrier and or the drivers to meet their needs, and sometimes it puts safety at risk.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scogin, in the letter that was passed out here from the folks from Pelican Rapids, it mentions that Texas passed a law in 2007. Do you know, is that the only state that has passed a law, and what is their effectivity on this? And, you know, are there other states that have already passed anything?
I don't know, and I saw that letter just late yesterday afternoon, so I haven't had a chance to look it up.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe our good friend from the State Patrol knows.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of what Texas passed. I haven't seen that.
All right. Well, Senator Scogin, I think we'll put this on the table for right now. And I already drafted the letter while we were sitting here, so we'll get some answers from the feds. And maybe if you want to do a little work on what Texas had done.
Okay.
We'll revisit this later. So. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 315 as amended be laid on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thanks for your help.
And members, this same bill was heard in the House Education Committee, and it's on the table in the House Education Committee. So. And now we have Senator Vandeveer. Senator Vandeveer, I believe you have a delete all amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Carlson moves the A090084 amendment.
This is
to get the bill in the shape the author wishes it to be in. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, members, what this bill does now is simply expands to statewide the authority of the commissioner to allow the use of transit buses and mobility buses on freeway and expressway shoulders that the commissioner designates as okay for that. It expands the permissible use to buses operating under contract with the Met Council or another transit authority providing regular route or metro mobility services. The commissioner, it allows the commissioner to require the bus drivers actually to undergo training in driving on shoulders, because there's some rules that they have to go by, different speed limits and things. So that's pretty much what it does. Any questions?
I don't have any questions, Senator Vandeveer. The department is here. Mr. Peterson or Mr. Rudine, would you want to weigh in here? Mr. Rudine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Eric Rudine, MnDOT Government Affairs, and we've been working with Senator Vandeveer on the amendment. And so now that the amendment is on the bill, we don't have any concerns.
All right. The commissioner is going to be able to take care of this. And all right. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Carlson would move that Senate File 208. Oh, Senator Dibble.
Just a quick question. I'm just not quite understanding paragraph D, then subsection 1 and 2. I was just trying to read through it and understand it, so I'm just slowing you down so I can understand it a little bit. What is this provision, Senator Vandeveer? I get the first part. It's just letting buses around the entire onto shoulder lanes around the entire state. But this says the term metro mobility bus means motor vehicle that is operated by or under contract with a public or private entity. Receiving financial assistance to provide transit services from the Metropolitan Council or the Commissioner of Transportation. So we're just expanding the definition of what a metro mobility bus is, and then allowing that kind of bus to use a bus shoulder.
Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I believe what that does is it. I don't think it's expanding metro mobility or impacting that. I think it's the way I read it is it. It allows a private contractor under contract also. It's an addition. I don't think it, my understanding is it doesn't alter the meaning of metro mobility bus. I think it's I think it's adding to who qualifies under this section to use the shoulder.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Carlson would move that Senate File 208 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Senator Vandeveer, just so you know, this may be included in the omnibus transportation bill as well. Okay.
Thank you.
This is just kind of a dual track in case the House holds up your bill over there. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On the Carlson motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
That went better than last time.
Yes, that bill went much better than the last one you had here, Senator Vandeveer. Senator Jungbauer, Senate File 740.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 740 is a simple bill, very similar to Senator Murphy's authorizing use of design build bill. It authorizes the process to Anoka County, but it's for a project specific to the city of Ramsey, and I have the mayor of Ramsey and the city administrator for the city of Ramsey here to explain the project. We have some other bills floating around, just so you guys understand there'll be some people coming forward asking for some other expansions of design build, and I'm I'm not sure how I feel about some of these. I'm a co-author on some of this. I think design build works for certain things, and I think we've got to be careful on what we pick out for projects. I don't want to expand it too much. But I think we're going to make the case today that the city of Ramsey in Anoka County on this specific interchange on Highway 10 and Armstrong Boulevard desperately needs it. So those of you that have watched the news lately know that Ramsey for the last year or so has been in the news with their city center project, and this actually would allow for to get some initial movement going on an overpass that would be extremely beneficial to getting that city center project moving forward for the economic development. And I think in this case, this project-specific idea is a good move in terms of where and when we should allow design build. So I'll let the mayor, Bob Ramsey, start out and tell you a little bit. And we do have some handouts if somebody wants to come and grab them.
We'll have somebody get those. Mr. Mayor, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you for having me. My name is Bob Ramsey, the mayor of Ramsey.
How'd that work anyway?
I think it went well.
That was easy for the lawn signs, wasn't it?
I like to tell people that my name was worth about 10% of the vote, and I got 12%. I won by 12, so I think I did all right. This project, I was looking at this before I became mayor, obviously, and as all of you are probably aware, our town center's in bankruptcy. You know, it was my opinion that this project, a $35 million city center project, was flawed with missing the $25 million interchange that it needed to support it. And there's also a couple of little issues here too as far as safety. You know, the city of Ramsey is primarily on the north side, north and east side of the railroad tracks, and we have no access to get across those railroad tracks. Our police and fire have issues with that. Trains go by, we can't get by there. But this project wasn't dreamt up because of the stimulus package. I want people to understand that. Even without the stimulus money, if we never get that, and I don't, it would be obviously a good thing for us. But the reality is, we got to move forward with this project some way, somehow. And it was my understanding that Design Build Authority would be able to move this project forward quicker and allow us to develop that city center.
The key members, now that you have the map, is the North Star Corridor when it operates and the trains currently operate, and there are no overpasses in that area. So if we need to get fire or safety apparatus across there, they have to quite simply wait till the train passes. So it's of utmost safety, especially as we start running the commuter rail. So that, again, is really the impetus for the economic development tool, but also the safety issue. And Kurt, the city administrator, is also with to give you a little more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. My name is Kurt Ulrich, city administrator. And this project really is a vital link to the economic development of this area and the success of the Ramsey Town Center and the safety of Ramsey residents, particularly in the area of Highway 10 and on the south side of Highway 10 to allow access for emergency vehicles and safe access onto and off of Highway 10. Currently, the railroad tracks are about 50 feet from the Highway 10 roadway, and this causes backup problems with traffic backing up onto Highway 10, creating traffic conflicts and potential conflicts with the train. So it is important both from a safety standpoint as well as an economic development standpoint to keep traffic moving in and out freely from this area. And with a combination of state monies, county, as well as local resources, we hope to accomplish the construction of this intersection. And we'll use all of our resources to bear to try to get this intersection completed in a timely fashion. And we appreciate your support. One of the resources that would help us tremendously is support for design-build process, which would allow this project to move forward in a timely fashion. Thank you.
And members, as you look at the map, what I want you to kind of pay attention to is you'll see fire station number one up here on the north or top side of the map and where this interchange would be located south of there. So the big issue also over at the right by where the rail station is proposed in the future is where police are also located. So everything is north of Highway 10, and should there be accidents or any kind of other safety concern on the south side of Highway 10, and there's a train going by at the same time, there is no other way to get across that track. And that's where it becomes an extremely important safety issue. So we'll try to keep it short and sweet. So, any questions?
Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. Further questions for Senator Jungbauer or his witnesses?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dahl.
I guess, well, it could be a question for you as well, Mr. Chair, or Senator Jungbauer. We've heard a couple. Now, this second one is design build. Was this going to be the precedent or the format we'll be following? Is just on a case-by-case basis, making whether we go to design build? It seems as though the biggest thing is whether we're speeding up the process to get these projects done, and are we just going to abandon our other ways of doing things simply because they're not getting done on a timely basis, so this is the way to go? Can I get some feedback on that?
Well, Senator Dahl, I think that the League of Minnesota Cities is probably going to be bringing a bill forward to give most local jurisdictions the ability to use design-build. Design-build doesn't work in every instance, but where it does, it's proven to be pretty effective, in my opinion. Granted, that's just my opinion, but I think that we've got a lot of statistical information to play it out that it is beneficial over the long term of a project. But once again, it doesn't fit for every project. Now, the city of Cannon Falls asked me to carry a bill for them earlier this year, and we passed that, and they're going through the process now, and that's for a fire station and a library. They may not be able to use it on either one of those two projects, but at least they have the tool in their toolbox now.
Mr. Chair, who will make that determination whether it's qualifies or is appropriate to use design build in these instances? Is that our job, or is it going to be MnDOT, or how does that, is that going to be determined?
No, according to the bill, there's a all of these design build projects have a panel of people who will be the ones that will say design build fits here, and here's the criteria by which you're going to play by. I should say design build best value, because if the best value is not design build, then you don't use it. So you always have to figure in that value part. But there is a team of professionals, and if you look on the very first page, they're talking about this design build selection panel, and then they name who they're going to be, and at least one member must be of a commercial contractor, two members that are professionally licensed, and I believe 326 refers to engineers, if I'm correct. They have to have, is that right, Senator Carlson? You have one of those?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Okay.
So each, Mr. Chair, each county will have to set up this design-build panel then? This one's for Anoka County. So as we move forward on this. And I know that's for this particular project, but I'm just trying to think long-term where we're going with all this. And it seems to me that's the trend, and I don't know if it's just for expediency purposes. We're actually going to be safer or get, I would like to see the projects get done, but I'm always concerned that if we start skipping steps that we're compromising safety and quality. And, having done construction here, I know that when you start designing on the fly as you're going, mistakes happen, and mistakes have happened up to this point anyway, just with the way we've been doing things, but I think we increase our likelihood, and that's my concern.
And once again, I believe that the League of Cities is bringing forward a bill that would offer this option up to all the local jurisdictions. But once again, these panels that will make up the decision are licensed people. They're professionals. I don't think any of the gentlemen sitting in front of us today, especially if I was a mayor that was the mayor of a city that had my own name hanging on it, I don't think that I would be trying to push anything forward just for expediency sake and you know, set aside any safety considerations. You know, when it comes down to it, there's a lot of people that always talk about giving local jurisdictions the tools they need and trusting them and all of that, and I think this is one instance where, we need to trust our next-door neighbors to do the best they can. So, Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chair, the last time we had a bill like this on the floor, there was a sentence that was brought to my attention that concerned me, and I see the same sentence in this bill, and so I'd like us to look at on page 4, line 4.22. To start with on 4.21, it says, the county must not consider cost-related or price-related evaluation factors in phase 1. And that seems to me unnecessarily limiting. I'm not suggesting that they ought to solely consider cost-related, but to instruct them to not at all consider price when that might, that might be something that they might want to consider when looking at how the whole thing is going to finally end up. So wouldn't it be smarter to say something like, the county must not solely or must not only must not have primary consideration of cost. Something instead of saying that they should not consider cost.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, that is the definition of design build.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, isn't in the definition of design build that cost is not the driving factor, that you have to look at doing it all in a different way, but not to just take cost out of the equation entirely? Can you say some more about that?
Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman, at least as I understand it, Senator Bonoff, that when the project is being considered, design build means that cost is not a factor. You're at that using that method. This is not competitive bidding coming in at the lowest cost.
Well, Mr. Chair,
that's that is right. It's best value. And if you have four people who submit proposals under this, then you can rate them on best value. And sometimes the best value for the community may be a project that costs a little more.
Well, the key there, Mr.
And
Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
Senator Riss, Senator Bonoff, is if you look back to line 4.17, in phase one, the idea is to pick your 3 to 5 players, and to pick those qualified players, you're not considering the price. But in phase two, you're definitely back looking at the price as a factor.
Senator Bonoff.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, I can appreciate all that, but to be instructed that, like, statutorily you can't consider cost rather than, I mean, value always has a cost-benefit assumption inherent in what makes something valuable. So I'm not saying that we should, that I'm trying to redefine what design build is. I'm just not certain that that gets us there to say you must not. I guess I would defer to if there's people here from MnDOT who are familiar with design build, or, I mean, if.
Senator Bonoff, up the page a little bit on 4.5, the sub 8, it says the county's estimated cost range of design and construction. So they have to put, you know, they think it's going to cost between, say, 1.5 and 2.2 million, for example. Although this is an interchange, it's probably going to be closer to 40 or 50 million. But so all the qualifiers have to come in that price range. Senator Dahl?
On this point, though, if we go back to just the definitions here and best value, it says that best value determination must include the price and must measure as responders' qualifications. So, and then later on we're saying must not consider cost-related or price-related evaluation factors. So it's How do we justify those? And then, because it comes down, it seems to me, it starts getting down to a little more subjective on what value is. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we do take the bridge, for instance, as an example, we did pay significantly more than the other three bidders. Did we get the best value? I mean, we got a good bridge, certainly, but did we get the best value? Mm-hmm. We don't know that for certain.
Mr. Chair and members, Chair. I think if you look down on line 4.22, though, and you think about how it's worded, you must not consider cost-related or price-related evaluation factors. So the price always comes in there, but when you're creating how you're going to evaluate these teams for the best value, that's not the factor you're putting in there.
I just said that phase two is.
So it's in creating those judging terms.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of things, but first to explain that, the phase one is just selecting the competitors, the smaller group, and you don't use price to select those. Phase two is when you go into the best value where you're actually using price to select the winner of the project. In the case of the 35W bridge, price was not the factor in picking the possible bidders. Right. Okay. When they narrowed down the bidders from everybody in the world to five, they were using phase one. So they did not have a price as one of the criteria to pick that smaller number. Okay. But I do want to say something, though, that to support Senator Dahl's question there, that using best value is, there's some negatives to it, and that is that the buyer, the owner, is taking more risk. There is risk inherent in this, and that risk is usually translated into the pricing of the entire project, because you don't know everything that's going to happen. That's the nature of design build. With design bid build, as you're doing that total design work, you're eliminating problems and you're making your choices. And so when you do a bid project, it's pretty largely defined, and you can get competitive bids that are in general lower than a design bid, the design build. And these days, there's also, I mean, hopefully you can get somebody going pretty quickly here, but these days you have a lot of hungry contractors, so design bid may be to your benefit at this point. But after there's a lot of contractors that are booked up, you'll get something like we had with the McCrossin and Mokota Bridge, where they were double the other contractor.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, and to Senator Dahl as well, I think as we look at more and more design build, that is kind of the key. You're looking at them almost a one-off deal so that we can clarify how it's going to work before we open up the gates, if you will. So I do think, you know, as I said, I'm on several other bills that have to do with design build, and it causes me to think more and more about how do we define it, how do we allow it, and what should the parameters be. So it is a thing that we look at one at a time, I think, until we know that we've got the right parameters.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
I need to correct a very grave error I made. It was the Flatiron people that were twice as much, not McCrossin, on the Wakota Bridge.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say what Senator Jungbauer said.
Okay.
Looking forward to the League of Minnesota Cities bill so we can have this conversation.
Right. Further discussion or questions for Senator Jungbauer or his testifiers? Senator Jungbauer, you're going to move your own bill here.
Yes. Do we have anybody that's against the bill at all? You never know.
I should ask that. Is anyone else here that wants to testify on this bill, either for or against it? I don't see anybody. then Senator Jungbauer would move that Senate File 740 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you.
Senator Rest, you're next. Yeah. Senator Rest, this is a, is this a department bill?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Agency bill. It's fairly straightforward, Mr. Chairman, and I'll just go through it section by section. Mr. Dean is here to answer any questions.
Okay.
The first section deals with being able to permanently record centerline locations, which are not now done on a permanent basis, and so that you can always be able to find where the actual center line of a road or highway is. Section 2 and Section 3 and 6 have to do with the, on the other hand, as I understand it, the very elaborate recording that is and bureaucratic red tape that is required when, because of variances, there is some change in the money needs of counties. And what those sections do is to not make that requirement so onerous. In Section 4 is an obsolete provision that is being struck. Section 5 increases the percentage from 1.5% to 2% for administrative costs with regard to municipal state aid street funds. Section 7 and 8 are clarifications of the definition of the definitions of expressway and freeway by making them a cross-reference to Minnesota statutes. And then Section 9, which may be the most interesting one, is a clarification in response to a court case where MnDOT prevailed, and it had to do with the how close a billboard sign was to a freeway when it had actually was on a non-freeway road. The MnDOT required the sign be moved. The company objected. It went to court. MnDOT prevailed. And what that section does is to clarify their authority to do so. And then in Section 10 is a it deals with a plat review along state rail bank corridors that they currently do not have that authority to review. But what is notable is that although they have the authority through this bill to review it, it's not a matter of approving of it. It's just a matter of evaluating it and getting information. So, Mr. Chairman, I think the provisions are fairly straightforward. I don't know of any opposition. There was some concern about the wording in Section 9, but as far as I know, there's no objection to any part of it. And if any members have need more detailed information, Mr. Rudin is here.
Yeah. Senator Rest, there is a fiscal impact in two sections of this bill. One is very small. It's probably less than $1,000, and that's those recording costs in Section 1. But there happens to be another one, and I believe it's Section 5. What we'd like to do is go ahead and pass your bill to the Finance Committee. Now, they're probably going to want to take Section 5 out, but we can carry that in our budget document because that is part of the governor's recommendation in his budget bill.
Mr. Chairman, would you want to take that out here before it gets there so I don't have to bother with it there?
We can leave Section 1 in because, like I say, that's like $1,000, and that's...
But Section 5,
But Section 5, I think...
It's a Well, Mr. Chairman, then I would move to delete it as long as you remember it.
Okay. Ms. Boyd will remember it. It's in the governor's budget bill, too, and we turned that one in. I think it was read today. And
sure. So. Mr. Chairman, I move to delete Section 5.
All right, on Senator Rest's motion to strike Section 5, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. And Senator Rest, we're not exactly sure how much that costs, but it's several hundred thousand dollars. So.
Okay. Right.
Senator Cope.
Oh, Mr. Chair, my question was going to voice a little concern and question about Section 5. So thank you, Senator Rest.
There we go. Senator Rest moves that Senate File 746, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, I was just curious, in Section 1, you know, all this detail about how exactly the survey needs to be filed on what kind of paper with a border, et cetera, which it seems kind of funny and old-fashioned, but probably conforms to how we file these things at the county. But does it preclude, electronic filing of these as well, make them more accessible?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, actually, to help me answer that question, I wonder if we could have Rick Morey from our land management office come to the table. He might have some more information on that.
Sure, Mr. Morey.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Rick Morey. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And as far as the detailed requirements for filing, that was done at the request of the County Recorders Association, who were much less specific in our original proposal that I forwarded to them for comment, and they were concerned about what sort of document they might or might not end up getting. So they asked us to spell out very clearly what it was they'd be getting, and that is why those details existed there.
Interesting. Well, you know, I'm fine with this. I mean, I've seen those big drawers with the big sheets, and sounds like what we're talking about here. But I think people are also looking to have these sorts of things available electronically now. But if the counties are happy, so be it. I'm not sure all the constituents will be happy if they don't.
Mr. Chairman, I think the major point was that there be a permanent record,
mm-hmm. right?
And our permanent recording of it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because currently, those center lines exist solely in our files out in our district offices in a file cabinet somewhere, and oftentimes these roads do end up being referred to by property owners in their legal descriptions of their properties as part of their boundaries, and so we felt as a service and a good citizen and neighbor, we should be filing these. I had talked to several counties, some of which were willing to accept our filings, others saying, no, there's no law saying you have an authority to file that. Therefore, that is why we brought forward this bill.
Senator Moy, your committee does look at these issues of filings, and are you going to need to see this in your committee?
Senator Russ, I don't think we requested this bill.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
Okay.
We took a look at it, and I thought this was really more of a transportation issue.
Okay, good enough. On the rest motion that Senate File 746 be recommended to pass
as amended
and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Well, he can still look at the costs.
Yeah.
Their fiscal notes.
Senator Rest, you have another bill now.
599, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A1 amendment, delete all.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, last year and again this year, I was approached by one of my constituents about the changing Minnesota's law to require lights be on 24/7. And Since that time, I have gotten a lot of information that is often conflicting with regard to safety issues, with regard to the impact on the environment, the impact of having lights on with for motorcycles. And with the delete all amendment, what I am doing, and I have had a brief consultation with Ms. McCormick from DPS, who thought, I think it's fair to say that this would be a good idea, is to ask the Department of Public Safety, along with Department of Transportation, to study the mandatory 24-hour use of vehicle lighting by vehicles on public highways, and to look at those jurisdictions and the experience, the research that's been done in Europe in particular. There are any number of European Union countries that require this, particularly in Scandinavia, but others as well. And there are some other states that do it also. Currently, Minnesota requires lights on in the daylight hours when there is limited when there's weather issues and when it is let's see what exactly the term is. Oh, Ms. Berezovsky has my materials, so I don't have that in front of me. But it is one of the least specific requirements with regard to lights on. So I think at this point that it would be a good idea to ask the department to look at that over the next year and a half and come back with some recommendations as to whether Minnesota should change its law with regard to lights on and look at these factors. Environmental consequences, and that one came from additional fuel costs. But there's very much disagreement about what that might be. Proponents of the this provision say that it's as little as $3 a year. Others would like you to believe it's $3 a trip, almost. It really does vary. So. And I think that we need to look at all of those factors and get some expert recommendations for the conditions in our own state, not otherwise. But look at what the experience of the European Union countries, Canada, which requires it, and other states. So, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's.
Questions for Senator Rest. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Resk, are you looking at different kinds of lighting here? I'm trying to find out if we're talking about headlamps, or are we talking about driving lamps or fog lamps or some other type of lamp?
Mr. Chairman, it would be fine with me if they looked at different kinds of lighting. Now, in Britain, in the United Kingdom, they didn't like it that the European Union was forcing them to go to headlamps. They wanted, as you might expect, lights that would reveal cars in the fog, rather than and be able not to see, not only to be seen, but to see better. In the fog, so to me, it's open as to looking at the experience of other jurisdictions and just making some recommendations. I'm thinking mostly of the of headlamps. There are any number of manufacturers now that have automatic ons in their for headlights, where the rear lights are not on, but the front lights are on. And that obviously is to be seen, not necessarily to see during the day. In some jurisdictions, that automatic feature has reduction in the power of the lights in order to use less energy to do it in the name of safety. Some jurisdictions claim that lives are saved because the vehicles can be seen. Some opponents claim that it is a safety hazard, and I would like for the department to look at where the truth lies for Minnesota.
Mr. Rudine, the department's going to be able to comply with this, not a problem. You can give us a shake of the head one way or the other.
I talked with Ms. McCormick, but...
Well, it was not a shake of the head. It was a shrug of the shoulders. So
there
you go. He's coming up here. Okay. Mr. Rudine.
Mr. Chair, I don't think the Department of Transportation would have any concerns about the bill, but I think you might want to hear from the Department of Public Safety, perhaps, since they would be enforcing provisions in the bill. It would probably fall more under their jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is now a study, Mr. Rudine. That's why I was... asking. It just asks that the Commissioner of Transportation and Public Safety get together and do a little research.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chair, the only thing we would like to keep in mind is last session we had a large number of studies the department was required to do, so if we just kind of keep an eye on that as we go through the session.
Yeah, and Mr. Rudine, once again, in regard to some of the information that we have asked for an ongoing basis, if you could provide us a list of that and what the department feels is are worthy endeavors and which ones aren't, we'll take care of it from there. I think this is probably a worthy endeavor. So. All right. Does public safety want to address this? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. One is, do we know what the estimated cost of this study would be? And secondly, it looks like where you're looking at is, and maybe you kind of answered it a little bit, but those jurisdictions you're looking at, do those areas, is all a voluntary action by the citizens to turn their lights on, or do all the cars that they have just automatically have them on, as you were suggesting?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, in the European Union, it's a requirement in the European Union, and then the countries have to comply.
Mr. Chairman, when you say it's a requirement, is it a requirement of the citizens to turn them on, or is it a requirement that all the cars have automatic on?
Mr. Chairman, generally what they have done is to require vehicles produced after a certain period to have the automatic on during the daytime with the reduced lumens as part of the manufacture of the car.
Okay.
And I think the date I remember without going through all of this is 2011.
Okay.
In the European Union. But they already have the law. Otherwise, you need to just turn them on.
Right. And Mr. Chair, then the Senator Rest, the cost involved approximately, do you know on this study?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't. Okay. But we asked the department to eat it.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. I think the department would be willing to work on the study with the Department of Transportation. I'm not sure if it would be DVS or be the Office of Traffic Safety or a combination or with the State Patrol, but it would certainly be something the department could work on.
Okay, great. Thank you. And, and Ms. McCormick and Mr. Rudine, once we get towards tying up our budget agreement, if you can let us know about how much money you've been spending on these types of activities, these studies, I'd appreciate it. Maybe there's a way that we could help out.
Mr. Chairman, I did find the standard in Minnesota is just simply insufficient light adverse weather. In mm-hmm. other states, headlight use is required when you turn on your windshield wipers, when visibility is less than 500 feet, when visibility in some states when it's less than 1,000 feet. Usually it's a visibility standard with with regard to varying distances. And Minnesota is, I guess you could say it's more general than that, but it seems to me that it's worth looking into if it's a matter of saving lives.
Yes, that was my predecessor, the former Senator Merkins, passed that law back in, I want to say, about 1989 or 1990. Turn the headlights on when it's raining or snowing or inclement weather. Further discussion on Senate File 599 as amended. Senator Rest, would you have any problem if we made this part of the omnibus transportation bill? Okay. Then the motion will be we will lay Senate File 599 as amended on the table for possible inclusion in the transportation omnibus bill. On that motion, further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Dibble, Senate File 916.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment. Senator Dibble, would you explain the A1 amendment? Or, well, this is the first stop for the bill, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'll explain it as I explain the full bill.
Okay. On the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 916 has to do with electric vehicle technology. As we're all now very well familiar in this committee, in order to reach our environmental goals that we've articulated across a number of policies and debates that we've had as a legislature from the transportation sector, we're going to have to take a look at a number of ideas. And we also know from various studies and presentations, the Center for Transportation Studies, the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, that we can reach those goals sooner rather than later with existing ideas, existing technologies, existing markets. Cars will, of course, remain the most important way that folks are going to be getting around. I don't know if Senator Day believes me when I say that, but I do believe that, and that's absolutely the truth. The most promising development, the technology that's the most promising in recent times, is the advancement in batteries that power electric cars. With today's technology, a car on electric power with a battery can drive about 100 miles without being recharged, and all of the performance expectations that consumers have with respect to speed, acceleration, cold weather, everything is there. These cars perform as well as any car. They're not the slow-moving Cushman that takes a long time to respond and only goes slowly and can only drive it around a golf course. And actually, when you operate a car on electric power, it's cheaper by the mile and it's cleaner, even if that power source is old coal. So you get ahead on two scores. Consumers are, of course, buffered from the variability and volatility of gas prices. But barriers do remain in adopting electric vehicle technology. Probably the key barrier is how much more expensive these kinds of cars are. They cost about $10,000 more when you include these batteries. Access to power sources. Most folks drive, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 miles per day. So access to power source isn't a big deal, but folks, of course, want to be able to get in their car and go wherever they want to go. And so when you're getting above 100 miles, you're going to really want to have access to power. Last fall, I had the opportunity to meet with the firm, flew out on my own dime with the Representative Frank Hornstein out to Palo Alto to meet with folks who are involved with a startup firm known as Better Place, and learned a little bit about some of their ideas. Better Place is just one of many, so I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about promoting any policies that benefit just one company. But they had some pretty innovative ideas. I think some other firms are taking up those ideas about how to get through some of those basic consumer market barriers, the $10,000 and the access to power. What they propose to do is work with automobile manufacturers to manufacture cars. They would then work with the consumer on a subscription basis for the battery that would go in that car. And so you wouldn't actually buy the car and the battery, so the incremental cost of the car comes down to the price of any normal car. And then you're essentially renting the battery, and you're also on a subscription basis purchasing power from Better Place, who works with the utilities to purchase power that then they turn around and sell to their customers. Other key piece is, of course, access to power stations so that you can just plug in your car either at your home or at a shopping center or where you work to kind of top off the battery. And if you have to travel more than 100 miles in a given day, you can pull into essentially what is a gas station, swap out a battery. It takes less than 5 minutes, and you're on your way to your destination. So essentially what that means is you're viewing the battery and the electric power like you're viewing your gasoline. When we buy our car, of course, we don't buy all of our gasoline that we need forever and ever and ever. We kind of roll that into our operating costs. And so that's what this concept does. It kind of rolls the battery and the power for the battery into the operating aspects of the car. So very quickly, they de-link the battery from the vehicle purchase costs. They create ready access to fully charged batteries and charging sources via battery exchange stations. Their goal is to widely distribute charging docks. The other innovative ideas they have is taking advantage of smart grid technology. That's not yet here, but at some point in the future, we'll have smart grid technology, and that's how these cars, as they're charging up, will interact with the utility company, with the power, so that they're not drawing power at peak periods. They can, they can draw power during off-peak periods, and as well, they can return power to the grid through a reverse, if they have excess power in their battery and the car is plugged in during peak period, there'd be a little bit of power there that either can be used for home on site or thrown back onto the grid to help in during hot days or peak use when there's not enough out there. And they're very adamant that this is very compatible with making use of renewable sources of energy. Very quickly, Better Place is working in Denmark, in Israel, Eastern Australia, the Bay Area of California, Hawaii, Canada. Every day we hear about another place that this particular firm, other firms are moving into other places to build out the infrastructure, to make the vehicles more widely available to the motoring public, working with large employers, working with government, working with a number of stakeholders in those areas to create kind of the environment for the infrastructure, the incentives, putting some incentives in place to help incent the adoption of this technology. Like I said, Better Place is one firm. Column Technologies, Google, there are many others. What this bill proposes to do, Mr. Chair and members, is just to try to articulate some simple ideas that don't have a cost or have very little cost, just to send a signal from Minnesota that we're preparing ourselves for this eventual market. As a broad overview, what this bill proposes to do is to give these electric cars access to HOV and HOT lanes, similar to how single-occupant vehicles have access now with transponders. All this will be free of cost. Streamlining some environmental and permitting regulations, standardizing some of the technology requirements for the vehicle charging sites, as well as providing for electric vehicle recharging, making sure that the standards are in place for new construction going forward, and just clarifies that a firm like Better Place wouldn't be a utility. Utilities don't want someone like Better Place to be considered a utility because that would violate servicetary regs, and likewise, I don't think a firm like Better Place would want to be considered a utility because then they get bogged down in utility rules. The amendment, Mr. Chair, just to be clear, simply says that on this HOV-HOT lane, it first allows the commissioner of MnDOT to decide whether or not this is a good or a bad idea. We first asked Commissioner MnDOT because there are some serious questions. Are we going to clog up these HOT lanes unnecessarily? So, and you can take whatever factors he has in mind to determine. If he does decide it's a good idea, he can regulate access to those HOT lanes, HOV lanes on a daily basis or on a rare basis, through those dynamic signs that they'll have overhead to say, today your electric vehicle is not allowed in this lane for whatever reason, probably because the lane is too crowded. Third, you can cap out the program, effectively sunset it if it becomes apparent that we're getting to a spot where there's too many of these. And really, that's appropriate anyways. This is just trying to kind of start and give a little spark to the idea in this market. And then ask the Commissioner of Public Safety to figure out, for their enforcement purposes, how you would mark these cars, you know, setting up the standards for it would be stickers or decals on the exterior of the car that marks that these cars are electric cars that can get into these lanes. That's my bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, let's go over the other lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, I'm really intrigued by the electric vehicles and hybrids and so forth, but I do have concerns about their being able to use the HOT lanes without driven by a single occupant without paying. When we did MenPass on 394, and your bill would allow them to go on MenPass without paying, we were told that the federal government, it's not the Commissioner of Transportation, it's the federal government that does not allow exceptions to congestion pricing by single occupant vehicles of whatever sort, because we had also considered when we passed that legislation allowing vehicles like taxi cabs, for example, that were deadheading back into the city to be able to save them gas and make them operate more efficiently. And we were told, no, that couldn't happen. We considered hybrids, regular hybrids on 394, and we were told that couldn't happen. And one of the experiences, so I would think that rather than the, at some point in the discussion here, rather than the Commissioner of Transportation having the authority, that you may want to consider having an amendment that asks the Commissioner of Transportation to ask for a waiver from the federal government for the purpose of allowing these kinds of vehicles to be on those lanes if it otherwise would be prohibited by federal rule or regulation or statute. And then further, you might think that there will not be very many of these to start with, but the and I would be very comfortable with your bill if that part was in there. But the Beltway in Washington was have HOV. I mean, they have HOV three. You have to have three people in the car, not mm-hmm. two. But they gave an exception to hybrids and single-occupant hybrid cars. The purchase of them went sky high, and they began, name one kind. Toyota?
Prius.
A Prius. They, you know, it got to be the case that it was just a big joke. Every fifth car was a Prius with a single-occupant driver in it who was able to go on the HOT lanes, and they had to stop it because they were were having congestion on the Beltway HOT lanes. And I've driven there any number of times because I have family there, and it was a mess. And maybe they've changed it recently and reauthorized their using, but the first thing is whether or not the federal government is a player in making the decision on interstate highways, and then secondly, what happens if people do want to sidestep the intent of the HOT lanes and buy these vehicles and then do not pay the congestion pricing issue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Senator Rest. I'm well aware of everything you just said, so that's why we invest the authority in the commissioner. The waiver piece is a good advice, and I appreciate that. But that's also why the commissioner is authorized to cap out the number of stickers, discontinue the program, you know, make that determination. I know about the Washington, D.C. Beltway. Read it in one of our governing magazines, and I think they're actually running into the same issue in the Los Angeles, Orange County, San Diego area. So got tons and tons of Priuses clogging up their HOV lanes, and they're actually thinking about going to,
yeah,
to a minimum of
Mr.
three
Chairman,
people.
And Senator Dinner, I appreciate that, but you may want to explore that the first issue then about whether the Commissioner of Transportation even has the authority to allow it. We had discovered several years ago with the men pass on 394 that it was not to be allowed. The only way you could, and maybe that was because it was an existing lane and had been developed under some existing regulations, but we were told we could not make exceptions. Nobody could make exceptions except the federal government, and they chose not to.
Thank you. Senator Day, question.
Mr. Chairman, and I was sitting here and I was thinking this bill should be dubbed the Sun City West bill. What I always hear, and I got to find out by the time that the session ends, everybody, in fact, you mentioned it when you started out, environmental goals. And I would like to know, what is your environmental goal? What are you trying to achieve? And what should I be trying to achieve in Owatonna? And I'm also, sometime before I leave here, I'm going to find out my carbon footprint
big one.
You know, do I have an 8-cylinder car or 4 or whatever. I need to figure this all out because I'm getting totally kind of confused. So, and I asked the other day when you had this individual here, and he was talking about emissions and the standards. And what, when you say we're trying to reach our environmental goal in the city of Minneapolis, which would be a wonderful place to eliminate cars and have all electric cars, a little band, that would be good. I would really love that. I'd vote for that one really quick. But what do you mean by our environmental goal? What is my goal or your goal?
Senator Day. Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just refer Senator Day to the 100 conversations we've had and debates on the floor and the statute books. We have very established goals around global warming, emission reductions, trying to reduce the criteria pollutants so that we're not poisoning the air, and trying to figure out ways to do that from a variety of different sectors, from the transportation sector, from the energy power sector, from the manufacturing sector. I think that's it's been a laudable effort on behalf of this legislature over the past couple of years. It's in the books. You can read it for yourself.
Mr. Chairman, this may be off of the transportation. Are we living, am I today in St. Paul, am I in a district where the breathing quality is getting poorer every year? And am I need to find this out because maybe I can help out more if somebody can convince. I'm not totally convinced on global warming. I don't know if that's a pretty debatable thing that I haven't quite come to grips with because I don't feel I'm quite that intelligent yet, and that's why I'm trying to ask some of these questions. So are we every year in let's say the metropolitan area, let's not say out where I'm at where there's a lot of nice clean air being blown around. Is it worse than last year?
Senator Dibble. Mr. Chair, well, actually, probably not worse than last year because people are actually driving less, which is amazing because the increases in miles traveled has been going up for so long, but it's kind of plateaued and dropped a little bit. People don't know why exactly. People guess it was the gas prices that created some changes. People haven't quite reverted back to the amount of driving. And also, I think it was an article in the paper today that said that a lot of people lost their jobs, so they're not driving as much as they used to. But for quite a while, as vehicle miles traveled were increasing, even though cars were getting better, we were experiencing more and more air alert days. In the wintertime, we get those air alert days, and that has to do with, you know, fine particulate matter in the air that's combined with a high-pressure system, and they say don't go outside and go running or do exercise. And we've also had in the summer ozone alerts in the metropolitan area and other kinds of air alert days. And actually, we were getting pretty close for a while to becoming what's called a non-attainment area. That's non-attainment of air quality standards that the federal government sets before us. And if we had actually flipped into non-attainment status, then all kinds of regs would be landing in Minnesota on cars and, you know, and roadway funding and transit investments and that sort of thing. Now we've dodged that, and we're getting better, but. But the short answer to your question is yes.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Dade,
do you think that maybe we should be looking at, instead of running a train to, what was it, Health Partners?
Wayzata,
or whatever, that maybe we should try and get some of these companies in to locate from Minneapolis to Mankato and Worthington and whatever, therefore to help? Would that be a good way to help alleviate?
I'm sorry to do what?
The environmental goal that you might have. We might be approaching it wrong by trying to get more people into a small area by maybe what we need to do is look at maybe trying to move some of these operations to out around the countryside and therefore help with your environmental goal.
That would work too. Mr. Chair, that would work too. And actually my other bill would allow for that. My other bill would actually allow for that.
I'll find my carbon footprint, and
so
you do the Sun City West electric.
We'll get together, Senator Day. We'll get this figured out together. I have a couple of Senator Bonner.
We still have Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, Senator Rest brought up the point I was going to make, because I actually wanted to carry a bill this session, and I did try it, I think, last session, on allowing hybrids to be in that 394 lane. And I pulled it. I didn't even drop it because I was told that the federal government didn't allow it. So I'm wondering, I hear what you're saying about places where they have allowed this. There's been so much congestion. But I'm wondering, if you find out that it's permissible, would you be at all open to including hybrid vehicles, or would you?
Yep, absolutely. Chair, yes.
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, should
Senator
we do that informally, or do you want to do an amendment? How do you want to handle that?
We're on our way to Senator Rest's committee, so we can do it on our way. How's that?
Thank you.
All right.
Senator Dibble,
we're on our way to Senator Prentner Solon's committee.
Senator Dibble, Senate counsel said that she was somewhat sure that the federal regs will allow zero emission vehicles in the special lanes,
but not hybrids.
Okay. Because they're not zero emission.
Okay.
Senator Cook.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Cook. And Senator Dibble, I've got two questions. One might be kind of obvious, but in page 3.5, you define electric vehicles, and you've got the three types of electric vehicles listed: neighborhood electric vehicle, medium speed electric vehicle, and plug-in hybrid. Now, you refer to Code of Federal Regulations, Title 49, above. I just, maybe this seems obvious, but first of all, are you allowing neighborhood vehicles that don't meet certain speed limits to be driving in the HOV lanes? No. Is that the federal regulation that you refer to? Or?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah, no. I ran across that, too, and had that very thought myself. I think the reason we do that is, as we're talking about the infrastructure where folks can plug in, around town or at their home, that's the reason we try to call all of those out, because there's going to be plug-in hybrid vehicles. That's a bridging technology. There's these neighborhood electric vehicles that Senator Jungbauer has been interested in, then fully electric vehicles as well. But no, we're not going to be letting those onto the freeway. And in any case, the Commissioner of Transportation has all the authority to establish whether or not these cars are going to be getting into HOV and HOT lanes.
Okay. And so then, Mr. Chair, this is my other question is regarding to Section 1. You're exempting projects that have to do with electrical vehicle infrastructure from the environmental impact statement. And aside from smiling a little bit at the irony, I'm just wondering What's the justification for that? And besides the fact that this is so important, we must build as quickly as possible.
Right. Senator DeVoe. Mr. Chair, because I believe in regulatory reform. I do. And also, if you go back, there's a rulemaking provision asking in Section 11 that asks the EQB to take a look at this and, you know, make sure that we're not completely flying in the face of environmental standards. But, you know, it's you know, if there's a proposal, I mean, I can't imagine that this would ever rise to the level of an EIS, you know, developing, you know, these little charging stations at various spots throughout the community, or sticking one of those battery transfer stations. But it's just really to, like I said, send a signal, Minnesota, you know, to the market. Minnesota's open to this idea.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to offer my services to committee members, and especially Senator Day. You know, when I took chemistry of the troposphere and environmental chemistry, I did figure out how to do carbon footprints and things like that, so I could figure those out. And then we'll, of course, have some fun by maybe comparing to such celebrities as Al Gore and Arnold Schwarzenegger and see how we rate on that scale.
Senator, Mr. Chair, I have some witnesses who would like to testify as well.
We have one more question. Senator Roy.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, you say that Minnesotans are open to electric cars and hybrid cars, and that may be, and I think you're probably right about that. And if they're so cost-effective, why do we need to have incentives? For me, this is like using TIF financing to build a Target and a Byerly's in Chanhassen, which we did. The people were coming anyway. Know that we were going to need grocery stores anyway. If this is so obvious in the market, why do we need incentives to encourage people to buy these kinds of vehicles if they're so practical and so cost effective?
Senator Dibble. Mr. Chair, well, we've seen some significant revolutions in telecommunications technology, for example. People are moving to cell phones at an amazing pace over the past 15 years. As a matter of fact, I just disconnected my landline. I've gone wireless. But that didn't happen magically overnight through, you know, market transformation, absent any public policies that help kind of pave the way. Now, there are no incentives, you know, monetary incentives in here, and, you know, we could talk about those, and I'm not against those. We just don't have any money to do that. But, you know, many, many policies were put in place, regulatory policies. You know, the Telecommunications Act at the federal level cleared the way so that cell phone providers could come in and site towers and build infrastructure, you know, very rapidly, and overcome a lot of local regs and the like, and streamlined environmental process, environmental review, et cetera. So even when we have very, very compelling market ideas that stand the chance of very quick adoption and transformation in the marketplace, there are public policies that can either help or barriers that can be removed to assist in that. The other point to recall is that, you know, I think the greatest benefit of this technology will go to those regions that adopt them more quickly. You know, a vision I have perhaps is converting the Ford plant into a manufacturer of these cars. That would be really great. We already have a tremendous amount of research going on in battery technology in Minnesota, and we could really spur that if the Minnesotans are really embracing this technology and transfer a lot of that research going on at 3M, and Senator Jungbauer knows all the other companies that are doing it as well, transfer that into actual marketplace and market activity. So that's the reason why I think, you know, these are some simple items. You know, other regions are putting a lot more in place, requiring that these charging stations be built in publicly owned parking lots, and that purchasing state purchasing mandates be put in place, and requiring that all new shopping centers build a number of these charging stations, and huge financial incentives as well that we just don't have the resources for through the fees or through sales tax rebates, things like that.
Senator Rutman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have federal tax incentives, I believe, for electric cars, and I think we probably have enough incentives. What I'm concerned about is this premise that it's the wave of the future, and it may be the wave of the future, but just adding more and more policy and more incentives, we create a tidal wave, and it swamps the current economic structure. It comes too fast. There's too much effort to push us in a direction that we're not really ready to go, and there's no reason why it has to come all at once. Why does it all have to come all at once? Can we just take our time with some of these policies and allow them to work and function? We're heading in this direction anyway. I'm not sure we need the extra legislative push at the state level.
Senator, well, I'll just first of all, you know, this is going to take a little while. I don't think there's going to be a huge rush. It's going to rely entirely. This doesn't make anything happen. This just allows something to happen. It's going to really rely on the advancement of these market ideas and the success of these firms to market their idea. And it's going to take a tremendous amount of private capital investment. Not one charging station is going to be built if investors aren't attracted in the local area to build these. And certainly nothing's going to happen if the public doesn't adopt these ideas. So nothing is forced in this bill. Ground is prepared and an environment is created so that if, in fact, a firm wants to come in here and do this, you know, the way is a little more clear. Not as clear as it could be, but a little more clear.
Senator Dibble, we are going to want to hear your testifiers. Senator Ortman has a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do think this is the proper place to have this debate, and so I appreciate the opportunity to do that now. It seems to me that Senator Dibble, taken on its face, it seems like it's not that big a deal. I mean, it seems like, okay. But then in this committee, we should be looking at the overall policy. And I think if you look at this in isolation, that's fine, but when you start adding it into some of the other policies, like let's study the vehicle miles traveled and some other policies, that's when it turns what is a natural wave in the economy into a tidal wave and has too big an impact. And I hope that your testifiers and support will address that maybe we're just taking this a little bit too far with all of these what might be reasonable approaches. There are too many of them, and it's going to have too big of an impact.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of folks from Fresh Energy who are here to help us out.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Erin Stojan-Rockolo. I'm the Senior Policy Associate for the Clean Energy Program at Fresh Energy. You probably know Fresh Energy is a St. Paul-based nonprofit, a nonpartisan group founded in 1990 that works on state, regional, and national public policy to achieve a clean, fair, and efficient energy system and global warming solutions. I'm going to make a couple of comments broadly in support of this bill, and then I'm going to defer to my colleague, Ethan Foley, who works with the Transportation Program, to provide more details. Fresh Energy strongly supports cleaner 21st century vehicles, including increasing the use of electric vehicles in Minnesota. We're here today in support of Senate File 916, which begins to create the infrastructure for electric vehicles. Electric vehicles offer Minnesotans the chance to expand our transportation system, the economic and environmental benefits we are increasingly enjoying from developing our clean electricity resources. Minnesota's clean energy resources can power our homes and our cars, and our citizens reap the jobs and economic development to boot. Further, since electric vehicles are generally charged at night, as we've heard, when the electricity market demand is low but wind production is high, electric vehicles offer an opportunity to better integrate renewable wind electricity into our state's electricity grid. Finally, electric vehicles, which are more efficient and less polluting, are another transportation tool to help us reach Minnesota's global warming pollution reduction goals in a way that grows our economy. They are also an important step in reaching energy independence. With that, I'm going to ask my colleague Ethan Foley, who is our transportation coordinator, to fill you in on some of the details.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ethan Foley. I work at Fresh Energy. I'll start with a couple facts. Our transportation sector accounts for 29% of our energy use in the state. Providing support for electric vehicles gives us a huge opportunity to take advantage of our natural energy and renewable energy resources right here in the state so that we can use that energy to power our cars and power our economy moving forward. Another fact is that 24% of the state's global warming pollution comes from the transportation sector. The
U.S. Department of Energy recently released a report that shows that given our current energy mix, electric vehicle and hybrid electric vehicles, which is plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, which is kind of a first step to the full electric vehicles, produce 29% lower global warming pollution emissions. And the Pollution Control Agency did a report last year that showed that as we move forward towards the Next Generation Energy Act goals, which will increase the proportion of our energy that comes from renewable sources, we can expect that plug-in hybrid electric vehicles would reduce global warming pollution by 34 to potentially 90% from our conventional vehicles. So this is a huge opportunity to tap into the energy that we're producing here in the state to fuel our vehicles, and it's a huge opportunity for us to reduce our global warming emissions. This bill supports the infrastructure to get started on this. It's just a great point to get started. Fresh Energy thanks Senator Dibble for bringing this forward, and we ask the committee to support the bill. Thank you very much.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know a couple other folks have signed up to speak. Otherwise, I'm ready to move the bill.
We have another question here from Senator Kelash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'm looking under Section 9 and with the battery charging infrastructure. You have a date of 2010, and some of the requirements for buildings being built after that at that time would require an extensive amount of electrical engineering in order to meet the goals, especially if you've got a 600-car ramp at the Mall of America, which is in my district, and the planning stages. And to have that many circuits in there is going to require not just a few plug-ins, but a whole infrastructure in case everybody was trying to plug in at the same time. I don't know if you've considered those costs, and also some of the projects that we're trying to get off the ground, even in multifamily, that require that we're looking, hoping to get ready to go, would also have to be stalled to be re-engineered to handle the new requirements and the codes that you're suggesting. I'm just wondering if we can either set that date back and maybe take down the number of parking stalls required to a certain percentage, at least for now. If there's some way we can fix that, because you're talking about building codes that are adding a great deal of expense to structures at a time when money is tight all over.
Senator Dibble.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm open to any of those kinds of changes, and I know the builders organization is working with Senator Hornstein specifically on some changes. Actually, they've said they're pretty much okay with most of this. They haven't honed in on that particular piece, the each individual parking space piece. But they're doing a lot of this already, they said. So we're going to be working closely with them. Those conversations have gotten underway. So it's a good point to bring out. I agree that if we need to move dates back or ramp down some of the requirements, that's part of the fun.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'd like to just make a friendly amendment to change that date on the construction codes from January 1st, 2011 to 2012, giving more time and let projects that are currently designed make it through the system.
Where are you looking?
On line 617.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
That's fine. That's a friendly amendment.
And Senator Dibble, are we speaking of both line 617 and 619?
I assume so, yeah.
Senator Kelash, is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I didn't catch the second one.
Senator Kelash offers a verbal amendment on line 617 and 619 to change January 1st, 2010 to January 1st, 2011.
12.
Correct? 2012. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Senator Dipple, are you complete?
Stand for question, or you can call other testifiers.
Any persons opposing the bill would like to testify? Do we have any? Ms. Scholander. And please, we are at 2:30 right now, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, my name is Alyssa Scholander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Members, I'm not here to oppose Senator Dipple's bill. I'm here to support Senator Dipple's bill. I just wanted to take a quick moment of the committee's time to thank Senator Dipple for this bill. This is not our initiative, but we wanted to just be on the record as supporting an approach that provides incentives to customers who are considering a new car purchase. We spend a lot of time around here lately talking about public policies that penalize driving and take choices away from our customers who need to drive. So any legislation like this that provides an incentive for consumers who are looking at new and exciting technologies like this that are coming to our showrooms very soon, we just wanted to take a minute to applaud. There are a number of automakers that are currently developing new products that use electric technology and other advanced technologies, and you know, we look forward to offering more of those choices to our customers, and incentives like this help make that a reality. So in sum, as the legislature does move forward toward the goals of creating a newer, greener economy, we hope that you will consider more carrots and fewer sticks to aid customers in their purchasing decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scholander.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In response to that, thank you very much, because I think in response to what Senator Ortman was saying earlier about incentives in the marketplace, I think we need those at times. Usually most of the time. I had a meeting with the chamber recently, and one of the members there, a banker, made a statement that usually the things that get done are the things that get incentivized, you know, as we move forward. And rarely do we see it moving forward with any efficiency or speed without having a little bit of that push. And I think it's our job down here to look ahead. Businesses need to make profit, do their business, and you know, and they're not always looking what's on the horizon for the big picture. And so that's where we can help maybe provide that at times. Sometimes it maybe turns out to be the stick and not the carrot. But in this case, it is the carrot, and I think. But the other part of it is not always the incentive that works; it's the proper incentive. So hopefully, this is the proper incentive to get things moving in the right direction. Thank you,
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Schlander, for your testimony. And you're right; all too often, we're kind of on opposite sides. And I think Senator Dipple has got a bill here that brings us all together. Mr. Chairman, in the light of the time here, is there anybody that opposes this bill? If not, I think that Senator Dipple needs to make a motion.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll move Senate File 916 as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to actually, we're first going to go to energy, and then I think we need to go to here.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
Why does it need to come to my committee?
I think I have a memo from you to that effect, so.
Okay. We'll figure out after. Never my decision. I do not administer the committee. Somebody else does.
All right. Are there any audience members who wish to testify against this bill? With that, we have a motion from Senator Dipple.
Rulemaking.
Yes.
To that Senate File 916, as amended, be passed and forwarded to
the Energy.
Energy Committee. All in any discussion of that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dipple. Senator Murphy, Senate File 453. And it is right now 2:34.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we're going to work with 453 first.
Okay, that's it, 453.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 453 is a simple bill that was brought to me by Mr. Krogman and the association that delivers propane for home fuel heating for heating purposes. Members, I do have an A1 amendment, and I think after this amendment goes on that nobody is going to be opposed to the bill. So I would move the A1 amendment.
Senator Murphy, would you like to describe the A1 amendment? Then we'll meet.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A1 amendment is pretty simple. It sets what we're doing in the body of the bill is allowing people who deliver propane to deliver during those seasonal weight restrictions if somebody's tank is dry. You know, the bottom line is we don't want anybody getting cold in the middle of winter. What the amendment does is set some parameters on when they can drive on the roads. We're trying to make them drive on the roads when they're still, in the early morning hours, when the road is still frozen before the sun can get a good hold on it.
Senator Murphy moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion from the committee? All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, that's it for the bill. I got a fiscal note here with a big zero on it, and
aye.
Well, that's the bill.
Aye.
Does anyone from the audience wish to speak to this bill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, evidently Mr. Vinosik's group still has some objections. I know that the townships are, because I talked to Mr. Slocum earlier, and he said that they were neutral.
Mr. Vinosik. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bob Vinosik, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Intercounty Association. We're an organization of 13 counties, 5 in the metro area, and 8 in greater Minnesota. They're largely the counties that are growing in size. Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties was here earlier, but had to be called away to another meeting, and so he's not here to testify, but both of our organizations have long supported keeping the ability to make decisions regarding seasonal road restrictions with the individual road authorities. The folks at that level are the ones that understand and know the conditions of their roads the best. And I think in the interest of time, what I'll do is I'll just cut my testimony short and turn to one of those experts, Mr. Darrell Petus, who is a county engineer from Le Sueur County, who can give you his perspective on the legislation.
Thank you. Please state your name. And
my name is Darrell Petus. I'm the Le Sueur County Highway Engineer.
Oh, yeah.
I also currently serve as the Vice President of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. And I'm here to speak today on their behalf. In December of 2008 and in January of 2009, both the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota County Engineers Association adopted a policy position regarding weight limits. It states, AMC and the County Engineers Association supports the prohibition of weight limit exemptions except during harvest. So we would testify not in support of this bill. This is a weight limit exemption. Trying to speed things up here, I will not go through my whole presentation. I'll just get some of my highlights here. In the past year, there have been a number of axle weight limit changes, including the raising to 10 tons per axle last year on all county paved roads, and also the special permits for 90,000, 98,000 pound gross vehicle weights for 6 and 7 axle vehicles for farm products. These changes are still being implemented. There are some issues with their implementation and the way some of the statutes were written, and we've actually been back into the legislature here to hopefully get some of those ambiguities corrected and taken care of. This Senate file adds cargo tank vehicles for liquid fuels and propane to the existing vehicles that are listed in the statute for exemption or partial exemption. Vehicles now include school buses and Head Start buses, vehicles transporting milk, public utility vehicles for emergency work, recycling, and garbage vehicles. All of the existing exempt vehicles do include a maximum axle weight limit. This Senate file does not include a maximum axle weight limit, just the limit that no vehicle may have more than 50% capacity in the cargo tank. Not being real familiar with these types of vehicles, it's not something we run into every day. I did make a call to our local fuel supplier, and they gave me some information on a couple of their vehicles. At 50% capacity for their two vehicles, they would be legal on a 7-ton road and during road restrictions. They're not legal, however, on a 5-ton road. I feel there would be some damage to our road system on the 5-ton road system when these vehicles are allowed. So what does it mean to our road system? In Le Sueur County, we have very few paved roads that are posted at 5-ton. We have a couple. Most of our paved roads are posted at 7-ton or greater. So these would work very well on our paved routes. There are a few miles, however, of paved 5-ton roads. And, in fact, the DOT system, the trunk highway system, is 18 miles of 5-ton load-posted roads within our county, actually more than the county has. The majority of the damage to our road system would be to our 5-ton road system. This is our gravel road system, both the county and the townships. Le Sueur County, we have in excess of 200 miles of gravel roads within our county road system that these would be traveling on. These are the roads that are covered by county program aid dollars and the property tax levy. Both of those programs have been reduced or limited in the last year to the levy limits and reductions in county program aid. So with that, I would like to end my brief testimony on this bill.
Senator Burke.
Mr. Chairman, there's two other folks that want to testify.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Senator Carlson, the committee, I'm Roger Leiter, the Executive Director for the Propane Association for the state of Minnesota. The Propane Association and our members serve over 250,000 homes, businesses, and farms in the state of Minnesota. While it may only represent 7 or 8% of all the energy out there, in rural Minnesota, that's 75% of all the homes. It is impractical to see that we could not make deliveries during the time of March 15th to May 15th. For most of our vehicles that we deliver with, they are overweight, empty on a 5-ton road, which basically means every 5-ton road out there, we can't make deliveries. This regulation would allow us to carry 50% of our capacity, which would put us in at the 7-ton level on all these roads. We would seek to minimize. Our people live in these communities. They're there as business people. That's their friends and neighbors. They drive those roads and pay for those roads themselves. They don't want to hurt them either. And in that case, that's why the provisions for not driving in the afternoons, driving in the morning, making most of the deliveries when it's frozen, would help to limit the amount of damage that we would have on those roads. One of the other parts is that between March 15th and May 15th, 16 to 20% of all the heating degree days for Minnesota occurs. We need to make those deliveries. And it's important that we can do so and do so in a legal manner. And that's what we're after, is to be able to have a way that we can make deliveries in the best way possible.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members deliver heating oil. That is in this bill. Our trucks are also overweight empty on the back axe. The only thing I would add to Mr. Leader's testimony is that this is not a daily occurrence. It would be one trip per heating customer per season, one trip over the road. It wouldn't be like some of the other exemptions, which are daily or weekly. One time in that 2-month period is when we would have to make a delivery. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Clifton Gipp, and I am the operations manager of United Farmers Cooperative, headquartered in Winthrop, Minnesota. I'm testifying on behalf of the Cooperative Network, the State Trade Association representing all types of cooperative businesses, formerly the Minnesota Association of Cooperatives. The Cooperative Network represents farm supply, grain, electric, credit unions, and so on, to name a few. Cooperatives deliver a significant volume of the heating fuel and propane in rural Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today regarding this proposed legislation. support what Roger and Bob have said about minimizing the number of trips. We feel it would be better making one trip at 50% than multiple trips being nearly empty to make these deliveries. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, just so on the record so the committee knows, and we're not putting any more exemptions in this bill. This is it right here. It's just this one exemption. Members, we heard the concerns from the counties. You know, I don't know what to say. I mean, these trucks are overweight, empty. We're talking about making sure that somebody gets heating fuel in their homes. I think that that's probably a pretty important thing to do. You know, and the industry is not oblivious to the concerns of Mr. Vanasek and others. That's why we put the amendment on there, and actually that was worked out with the Township Association. And in my opening remarks, I thought that everybody was kind of on board here, but evidently that's not the case. But, you know, once again, this is it. This is the only exemption that's going to be in this bill. And, you know, I would move the Senate File 453 as amended.
Senator Murphy, I have one question for you. Is it true that in the past the governor has allowed this by executive order?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Berezovsky thinks
yes.
That that's correct.
She did last
say
year.
Yes. And Mr. Krogman just says, yes, last year they did that. So
last year it was done. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't have any problem with the bill because I'll vote for it, but I will tell you, when I come here with sweet corn, they throw me under the bus. When Roger Moe comes here with sugar beets, they throw him up on the top and wonderful. If potatoes up north is good. So it's kind of, depending on what you come before this committee with, it, you know, I don't mind all of them, in all honesty, but it's kind of interesting after I've been here all the years of all the exemptions they have, and it seems like whoever you are that has a little power seems to get the exemption. If you're in the minority, you could be feeding all the kids in the world off of your sweet corn for 2 weeks, and you could get squat. So just so you know, I'm just throwing it out there. And someday I'll be back with my sweet corn.
Senator Dave, it's for emergencies for each of us, and sweet corn would be an emergency for me, too.
Yeah,
so
me
would
too.
Popcorn. Senator Murphy moves Senate File 453 to be recommended to pass. And
as amended.
And forward it to the floor. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Murphy moves Senate File 453. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passed.
Well,
thank you, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're out of time here, so Senator Stump is going to come back and present his bill first on Thursday. And
you have another bill that you carried.
I realize that, Mr. Chairman. We'll have to put that on next Tuesday as well.
Great. Thank you, Senator Murphy. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.